This is Wells Tech, a show that explores the intersection of technology and ministry. Wells Tech is a part of the Streams Media Network sponsored by Wells, the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Your show hosts are Martin Spriggs and Sally Draper. Join the conversation at wellstech.wells.net. Welcome back, everybody, to Wells Tech. This is episode 455, recorded on July 26th, 2016. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Martin Spriggs. Show about technology and ministry and helping me navigate those waters, find those intersections each and every week. The lovely, the talented Sally Draper. Hey, Sally, how are you?
I am awesome. How's that for anticipation? Wow, that's awesome.
We're both wearing our Wells shirts today.
Yeah, right? Got the colors showing. All right. July 26th, a very happy day in my memory because this is the day I had my oldest son was born. And so day that Kevin and I became parents officially and especially special this year. And I need to just take a minute and do a shout out to Stanley because he's turning 21, my baby, all grown up. So happy birthday, Stanley.
Yeah. And boy, were you glad probably to give delivery in a long, hot summer.
The long, hot summer, and I had chicken pox for the last month
of my
pregnancy.
Goodness.
It was quite memorable. So we were happy to have him.
Congratulations to you and Kevin and to Stanley, of course.
Yeah, thank you.
How many years?
21.
Oh, boy.
A big one.
How'd that make you feel?
Yeah. yeah. I earned it. I got the gray hairs to show, and it's all good.
Good. Well, another thing that can give people gray hairs is the topic for the day. And this summer, we're trying to take a lighter tack and a little bit shorter show. But today's topic is pretty heavy because we're continuing our month of security conversations. And we've come to the time where we really need to talk about policies because there's a lot of do's and don'ts related to security. And a lot of those do's and don'ts need to be written down. And summer may not be a bad time to kind of catch up both on your understanding of existing policies, whether they be national, local, or your organization's policies, or for the creation of said policies that perhaps are missing in your organization. And we're going to talk about both of those, some of the things that you need to be aware of that are out there, get smarter on, and there are plenty of tools to help you do that, and we're going to talk through some of those. But also some of the policies that if you don't have, maybe you want to think about putting together, and we'll give some examples of those as well.
Yeah, Martin, you mentioned the month-long series. We've talked about great passwords. We've talked about backing up your data and also about the last topic that we talked about, just on the tip of my tongue.
Viruses.
There you go. How to avoid those. I just had all those in my brain and they went away when I started talking. Anyway,
what happens when you have a 21-year-old.
Yeah, apparently. All those discussions were more or less personally directed. So you've got to be smart about your passwords and do these things and things like that. You need to be smart about your data and back it up, and you need to avoid viruses. But you're right, as we start to look at policies, we take those individual practices that all those workers in your school and your church and volunteers and people that have access to different things, all of them are making decisions individually about those things, and we corporately need to tie that up into some policies so that everybody's educated and everybody's more or less maybe even forced to comply at times, like passwords expire after a period of time or whatever it may be, so that you as a group, a congregation, a school, whatever it is, have taken the steps that done your due diligence to ensure that everybody knows what's going on and is acting responsibly.
Yeah. So the first category maybe we should talk about of policies are those that you put in place that your users, the people within your organization, the people on your network, need to follow. And there are three that come to mind right away. One of them is an acceptable use policy. And we have a big old long one here in the Senate office that talks about things that you can do and things you can't do. And it's important to kind of think through all the things that you'd like your network used for and those things that would be abusive of. And we've got a couple of examples of those that we can provide, but essentially it's going to be things like abuses that would maybe be the same in your household as they would on a network as well. And you could deal with things like use of social networks, bullying, all those kinds of things, but there's a lot of things that you would want to kind of prescribe in an acceptable use policy. And some of them are common sense, some of them maybe you wouldn't think of, but that would probably be the first one that I would put together. What are the rules of the road when you get on our network? What should you download? What shouldn't you download? What shouldn't you upload? What shouldn't you be doing on our network? And it could be very obvious things like viewing pornography or engaging in illegal activity, perhaps gambling sites. It all depends on what your acceptable use policy needs to cover, but all of those things need to kind of be spelled out just for your own protection.
And, you know, I mentioned earlier, this is for employees, volunteers, obviously, you're going to have called workers and things like that in your churches and schools. But I think where you get the most exposure to acceptable use policies, at least in our current settings, is in a school setting in relation to the students using your network. And especially as more and more schools go to one-to-one, you know, when is it acceptable to use your device? When is it not? You know, it's not to be used unless instructed by the teacher and only to sites that are approved and things like that. So you get really concrete with what is expected of the students when you hand them devices and give them access to the internet and things like that. Yeah. Actually found a website, Common Sense Education, that has a really great background and information about setting up one-to-one acceptable use policies for your school. So, and those may be good templates for you to use, you know, broader than just the students. Obviously, you're going to want to address it with the adults that are there as well.
Yep. And a close cousin to an acceptable use policy is a code of conduct. Sometimes those are one and the same, but a code of conduct really deals with how you as, and this is mostly, well, I guess it could be for students as well, but for the employee, for the call worker, for the volunteer, whatever, what you do reflects or how it can reflect on the organization itself. So how you conduct yourself on social networks, for instance, on the church or school's Facebook page, what you tweet, how you treat each other, you know, online, if there is an intranet or something that allows person-to-person communication, any of the social networking kinds of sites. So code of conduct is something that you probably want to roll out as well. And you can think of things in terms of not just a digital world, but, you know, code of conduct does apply to, you know, things outside of a digital world as well. So that would be another one. And then the last one I thought of, Sally, in this kind of category would be just good old-fashioned password policies. When you set up accounts, when you have access to quote-unquote private or classified content, you want to make sure that your policy for setting passwords is strong, has some requirements to it. Is, you know, you can't use the word pencil. You've got to use something that has, you know, upper and lower case, maybe a special character or two, a number, and then enforce that. And most of the systems that you probably put in place have the ability to set that password policy.
Yep, and we actually have great resources for all of these different things. So if you're looking for a starting point on setting a password policy or doing a code of conduct for your church or school, definitely go over and check out the show notes. There's some password policy templates and ideas for wording and things like that you can certainly borrow and modify to your needs.
Yep. Maybe before we leave that category, there's a similar one that we should throw in here quick, and that is password policies related to mobile security. Most of our phones will have access to, could have access to sensitive material, you know, the church database, a school student information system. All of those are things that you want to protect, and the mobile access to them needs to be protected as well. So rules that regulate, even if it's not a phone that your organization provides, you can require certain password policies or procedures that be in place for any device that you allow access to it. So strength of password, PIN on a phone, make sure you use fingerprint ID if the phone provides it. Those kinds of things need to be thought through and put in place as well.
And just from personal experience, I know of one organization that someone just got up to go to the bathroom in a public place and their laptop was gone when they came back, or locking it in your car trunk, the windows have been broken and things stolen or whatever. And so maybe even some guidelines around securing those mobile devices, which are so easy to be lifted and whisked away in just a moment, so that people are more aware of things like people looking over their shoulder as they're looking at data on them or whatever. So not necessarily just the physical passwords and things, but also just wise and defensive use and practices with those devices.
Right. Another category we thought might be worth discussing real briefly is this whole concept of social engineering. And this is probably, this whole category is probably more responsible for privacy breaches, security breaches than anything else. And social engineering is simply the ability for an individual to penetrate a network or penetrate security within an organization just through conversation or emails, where they are representing themselves as somebody that you perhaps would want to trust, but really shouldn't. So they're getting you to give you a username or password, or give you access to something that they shouldn't have access to. And they're very crafty, and we've probably seen or experienced some of this in our own personal lives, where we'll get phone calls from somebody that maybe seems reputable, or an organization that we would otherwise trust, and we get an email from them or a voicemail from the IRS or somebody like that, and they're asking us for specific information, and we're inclined to give it to them, but we really need to be careful that they are who they say they are. And this is happening all the time. There are very famous cases and case studies about individuals who have become so good at this that they could really break into almost any network or any organization without having to do any hacking whatsoever. They just need to call the right person who gives them the right information, and then they're in. And so this could easily happen in one of our organizations, where especially you have volunteers maybe answering the phones and having access to sensitive data that may not know all the rules or may not know everybody that might call into the church or school office. So you'll want to have conversations and maybe some guidelines for all those people who have access to data to watch out for this. And, you know, we've got a great resource here in our own Synod office, Rob Benson, who we've had on the show before, who will regularly send out little emails or blog posts that talk about how some of these things can happen, these phishing attacks or these social engineering schemes that you'll want to watch out for. So you'll want to do that in your organization as well.
Right. And again, even if you are aware, your organization is only as strong as the weakest link. So exactly. Make sure you don't have weak links. Invest the time and make sure everybody understands their responsibilities and the dangers that could happen for that.
So the next big category that we should talk about are those maybe federal laws that we probably need to be better aware of than we are today. And I'm speaking of policies or laws like HIPAA and COPPA. HIPAA governs medical information, personal medical information, which schools often carry, especially if you have a school nurse program. You collect information on immunizations and medications, those kinds of things. So you want to be careful with that and understand that. COPPA deals with children's online privacy protection. And there's just a wealth of material online. And I'm not saying that you should necessarily read end-to-end those specific laws, but there are plenty of great articles online for organizations to read that really kind of pull out the important points, the salient points that are important for your organization to be aware of and then pass along that information to people who need to know it. So those are the two big ones. There are others, and different municipalities and different areas or states have different things that you may need to pay attention to. But those are the two big ones that would apply in many cases to our schools especially.
Yeah, and Martin, I thought of HIPAA in terms of our pastors out doing hospital visits and sharing prayer requests and things like that. But I actually did a little reading of some of these great articles we have, and it turns out that HIPAA doesn't really apply to churches. HIPAA right. specifically applies to the medical entities that are dealing with medical issues, like the doctors and nurses and the insurance companies and things that right. are handling those claims. However, it does make sense to take the lead from that and, you know, be aware that there are privacy concerns for very good reasons around medical things. And, you know, obviously someone who's a nurse that's a member of your congregation shouldn't be passing along, you know, in private information that they're aware of in their professional role and stuff like that. But in terms of the church itself, it's not specifically under legal requirements for HIPAA, but definitely worth understanding and being respectful, irregardless of whether it's being mandated on you.
Maybe the last area that I'd want to talk about, maybe you have others, Sally, is the use of public Wi-Fi or the availability of public Wi-Fi in your on your campus, whether that's church or school. It's a good practice to obviously put rules and regulations around that, and more congregations are adding that to the fellowship hall or to the sanctuary or whatever, you know, kind of an open Wi-Fi area. So it's probably good to have some kind of acceptable use policy even for that, so that is not abused. And there are different ways to do that. When you set up your Wi-Fi network, sometimes there are capabilities that ask people to sign in so you know who is there. Maybe even it's not password protected, but they have to put in who they are. And you've probably seen this in hotels all the time, mm-hmm. where you go to a page and then there's a policy that you have to click through and say, yeah, I agree with that. Would not be a bad idea for any organization that has any kind of public access where people are coming and going and using the network just for your own protection and to keep the network clear and safe.
Yeah. And then, of course, we talked in our last show about personally using VPNs and things like that to avoid yep. actually surfing on those networks. But yeah, kind of a couple of different angles to public Wi-Fi.
So in the interest of keeping things short and light, maybe we shouldn't go too much further with this topic. We, again, will have a bunch of resources on our show notes page, wellstech.wells.net. But just again, the general encouragement, make sure your policies are up to date. Make sure you're aware of any laws that you need to be paying attention to. And probably set a time each year to review those. Laws do change things. You know, technology changes. You have more capabilities when it comes to applying security. And just a reminder to entire staffs or faculties or whatever that, you know, that these things need to be paid attention to. You're getting maybe new faculty members, and volunteers are always coming in that are potentially new, etc. So just keep aware that this is not something you can just kind of look in on every 3, 4, 5 years or when something happens, but be diligent here.
Yeah, interesting thought, Martin. I'm kind of wondering where it might fall under typical congregation committees and things, and maybe it's a need for a risk management type committee. I know we have risk management folks in the Senate offices, and they, you know, focus on this kind of thing, as well as ensuring insurance policies and things like that are in place. So risk management might be something to consider.
And that you raise a good point, because many insurance policies now offer some kind of digital or cyber protection as well. So if there are breaches of data or whatever, there are coverage add-ons that you may want to look at as well. We do that every year here at the Synod level, just to make sure that we're aware of all the products that are available for coverage if some things happen, bad things happen online that would ultimately protect us.
Sure.
So let's move on to the next segment of the show, which is always picks of the week. Sally, you have a pick this week?
Moving right along. Yep, I do. And I have to give a special shout out to Pastor Emil Burgess, because this pick comes to you courtesy of him. He actually tagged the website typeform.com in our Wells Tech DIGO group. Wow, there's too many for me to remember even these days. DIGO, where you can bookmark different things. So thanks for sharing that, Emil. And Typeform is a new way to do online forms. And it's just got a hip kind of fun interface. Basically nice color backgrounds and things. And it only asks one question at a time. They're laid out in fun kinds of ways. And then as you finish one question, the next one scrolls up on the screen. So you're not just looking at this endless form, but instead just focusing kind of on one thing. You can actually get started without creating an account at all. And they do have free plans as well as priced plans at various levels. They offer you some templates. So if you wanted to do a registration form, for instance, you could just open up that template, and there's ways to work with this. But yeah, you just would give it information, and it kind of simulates what the form would be like. And if you want to use that template, then you can go into more of an edit mode where you can make changes to it. So it asked me my first name as an example, and then it says, "Hey, Sally, nice to meet you." So it's a little bit responsive to what I've put in on the form already. And then it continues, "What's your last name? What's your email address?" And it has like, "Don't worry, we're not going to spam you," things like that, you know. So very friendly, interactive interface, and kind of just walks you through, gives you just a little to focus on at a time. Seems like a really great tool, and I'd want to dig a little deeper and try it out on a website, see if you can embed them and things like that, that you can do with other form tools. The tool is called Typeform, typeform.com. So if you're looking for something fresh and in terms of your online forms, maybe you want to check it out.
So it's almost like kind of a bot model, where it's walking you through kind of a series of more casual one-off questions, and then kind of takes you to the next level, versus, you know, a page full of, you know, 20 fields, you know, and a submit button at the bottom. It's a little bit more conversational, maybe. Mm-hmm. Not the exact right word, but it seems a little less threatening maybe than a regular form. Maybe that's the best way to put it.
Mm-hmm. But it really is just still asking the same kind of stuff.
Right.
It's bigger. It probably looks really good on a mobile device, because right. It's just centric to that. And I saw examples, you know, rating. Sometimes you have to rate things, and maybe you have 1 through 5 or a slider scale. Well, it had thumbs up, little images of thumbs, and you could click how far along the line you wanted to give it your thumbs up rating or whatever. So just a little more fun, intuitive, and also definitely mobile friendly. So
did you play with it long enough to know what the reporting side was or the data side was?
I haven't gotten that far, so I'll have to have a part two.
Okay, we'll have to maybe get Emil to share with us a little bit about how he's using it and how he likes that part of it. So.
Sure.
All right, my pick. I am probably, I don't know if I've shared this on the show before, but I'd call myself a smartwatch skeptic. I've tried a few in the past, and I've always either returned to no watch or just a regular just a regular watch, an analog watch, because I just haven't found them to be overly useful. But a while back, probably earlier this year, my kids were all chipping in on each special occasion, whether it was birthday, Father's Day, or whatever, with Apple gift cards with the intention of me getting an Apple Watch, because they all had one and I didn't. So they wanted me to join the party. So I finally did that about 2-3 months ago, maybe. You know, it was shortly after Father's Day, I guess. So it was
just that would have been 1 month ago.
Months ago. Yeah. I haven't had it that long. But so I did buy an Apple Watch, and I have to say, at least my initial review is very positive. Now, I have installed the latest beta, which has made some nice improvements to the Apple Watch. Those of you that have them and have some complaints about them, I bought the cheapest one, the Sport Watch with the Sport Band. And the two things that I like the most about the watch are kind of the keynote features, and that's notifications. So if I get a text message or some other kind of notification from my phone, it'll appear on my watch. And probably even more than that is the fitness feature. So it does step tracking. It does heart rate monitoring. It'll do mileage. And then it obviously gives you some tools to see that if you can compete against yourself. So it'll track you day over day how you're doing with activity or exercise or steps, or it reminds you to stand once an hour. You can turn all this off or on. But I would say in general, it's probably the best fitness device I've ever had. And I've used Fitbits and some things like that before. But I've found that this seems to get it really, really right. Now, one of the negatives is battery life, although I've never run out of battery in a day. It'll always give me a full day charge, and I'm just used to putting that on the charger on my nightstand. So that's not a super big problem. It's really easy to view in daylight, which is nice. Not all fitness watches are that easy to view in direct sunlight. So if you're using this for running or walking or hiking or whatever, that's a real plus. It seems to be pretty durable. It's comfortable, at least the Sport Band is. I haven't tried any of the other ones. I think it's well done, and it's getting better with the new beta. The application launching has gotten a little bit faster, and they have a lot of different choices for watch faces, etc. I'm just really a fan of this. And of course, you need to buy, it needs to be paired right now with an iPhone, or it's not going to function. It needs an iPhone to function well. But it's not inexpensive. I think it was about $300, maybe a little less. I think I got it on sale, something like that. And they go through the roof with, you know, some of the other bands and such. But in general, that's why I'm making it a pick. And I'd kind of waited a few months before I did make it a pick, because I wanted to kind of put it through its paces. But really happy with it. My wife, Debbie, is really happy with hers as well. And I think there's maybe even more advantage for a lady over a man when it comes to notifications, because ladies don't always have a pocket or something to put their phone in. So she can have her phone, you know, on the counter or wherever, but the watch will then notify her of text messages or phone calls. Siri works through it. She can make phone calls and receive phone calls on the watch, so that distance from the phone is not an issue, or digging it out of her purse or whatever. She just likes it because now she doesn't miss those things where in the past she did. So thumbs up for me at this point. I mean, I'll give a review later on this year after I've, you know, lived with it for a number of more months and kind of kicked more of the tires of it. But so far, so good. I really like what Apple has done with the Apple Watch.
So perhaps you heard me typing while you were talking as I frantically searched for the episode where you called me, I believe it was a digital dinosaur for wearing a watch. Do you remember that by any chance?
I do.
I do too. And I'm thinking you're wearing a watch these days. Do you actually look at it for a time?
It does tell the time, yes.
Yeah, but do you use it for that?
I pretty much know what time it is through all the screens that I usually have in front of me, but okay. The date is important. I don't always know the date. And I have a watch face that gives me my next appointment, which is actually very important to me as well. So
there you go. So, well, I just was having a little flashback there, Martin, and wondered if you remembered those.
Right. And you don't wear a smart
lovely
watch, do
phrase.
You wear a step tracker.
Yeah, step tracker. It has a watch on it, the time on it. So,
by the way, just an update on my step bet progress.
Yeah.
This was the first week. Yesterday was the first day of the 5 weeks. It's really 6 weeks, but the first week is a test week, which I failed, and I wasn't really motivated to get all my goals. But in earnest, you know, it was yesterday, and I made my active day. Now I've got two more active days and two stretch days. So I had about 12,000 steps yesterday. My
good
stretch day is 14,500. So we'll
wow.
see how that goes. But didn't have too many problems yesterday making my my step goal. But so if I make it, if you didn't listen to last week, if I make it through 5 weeks, I get my $40 back plus a cut of all those who didn't make it through the 5 weeks. So
okay.
It's called step bet. We'll see. It's pretty motivating.
You yeah. know,
you're going to lose $40.
The money's on the line.
It's a lot of pressure.
All right.
Debbie and I are doing it together. So it's kind of a family thing. It's pretty cool.
Good for you. Good for you.
Let's move to community feedback, Sally.
I have a little community feedback to share, and first an apology to Perry Lund because I forgot to include this in last week's show. So it's actually a week old, but Perry actually commented on the two previous week's shows on security. First, regarding passwords, he said password repetition is something that can be removed from the computer user's mind with programs like 1Password. I think we talked about 1Password as a password keeper and generator and things like that. He says he paid close to $50 for the software, but the past 6 years have been trouble-free in terms of remembering passphrases. So he gives 1Password highest recommendations. And then regarding backups, he also wrote to us and he said, I can speak to several of the options that we shared as backup options. They are lifesavers and time savers. Super Duper on Mac is the finest shareware you can get. It works great. I've actually had a second hard disk in a mission critical machine for a client, and when the hard disk failed, the Super Duper clone drive booted the machine and the client never knew a problem had occurred. He received an email about the drive failure and replaced the failed drive. So it was a seamless kind of thing. He says, your list is missing a great software product for backup, and that is CrashPlan. And I know we've talked about CrashPlan mm-hmm. in the past on the show. I actually have the website up here. It says set to work. Whether you're a small business with 1 or 100 employees, CrashPlan makes it easy to protect your business data. So Perry goes on to say it comes from the state of Minnesota, and it's very cost effective and the most transparent backup I have used. PC, Mac, Linux, they all work. It's Java-based clients, so that might bother some people, he said, but it is Java-based. So that's CrashPlan. So thank you very much, Perry, for sharing your experience with passwords and backups.
Great. So if you're using one of those programs, really one of the points of them, if they're good, is that you never really see them. So the fact that it's a Java-based program shouldn't bother you too much if it's doing its job well. You know, you really never want to spend much time in the interface because that'd be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. All right. Then we someone found a new blog that might be of interest to folks.
Yeah, I came across this. It actually appeared in my inbox today, Facebook for Nonprofits, which I think we've talked about on the show in the past. It was quite a while ago, has launched a new blog on Facebook for Nonprofits. So they had provided good information about how best to use Facebook as a nonprofit to engage potential donors or members, increase sharing, all those kinds of things. But this blog now will kind of be a regular feature where they'll write more extended articles about some of these concepts that probably apply to most of our listeners. If you have a Facebook presence for your organization, this may be worth bookmarking and reading on a regular basis. The last I looked just a couple minutes ago, they had just 3 articles up, but I'm thinking that over time they're going to continue to bump that up. So it's they've got obviously a wealth of experience and probably a good read. They've got articles on how news feeds work and fundraising tools, those kinds of things. So may want to bookmark that. We'll have a link in the show notes.
Yeah, I like this very first headliner and the subtext. It says, find the right people. And it says, defining your audience as an important step in being a more effective communicator with your Facebook page. And that's what we say all the time on Wells Tech, is that you need to know your audience, know what they're looking for, and how to support them and the things that they need. So exactly. I find that to be right on target. Awesome. All right. We have a little photo contest going on these days over at the Wells Tech Photo Challenge, wellstech.wells.net/photo challenge. And this month, the month of July, is actually the last month of our photo challenge. We are looking for pictures of summer outreach and Isaiah 52 verse 7. I am so excited to say that we have 916 photos, closing in on 1,000 photos on our royalty-free public domain.
Well, it'd be nice to get 1,000. It would be nice to get 1,000 photos, wouldn't it?
Sure would be cool. So it's definitely full of things that you can make use of in your church and school settings, and all of them completely free to use and public domain. So and
these are not, I wouldn't call any of these slouch photos. No. I mean, there's some quality stuff here. So if you have not been to the page, go to our show notes page and click the link there. It's pretty impressive.
It is. I'm super excited.
No thanks to me, because I don't think I've contributed a single one, but well, that's okay.
We'll take 84 from you this week, please, and then we can reach 1,000. How about that?
except I can only upload 3 at a time. I just have to fit that in with my steps this afternoon.
You can make it happen.
Okay. All right. I think that's it. Speaking of the photo challenge, next week, since this is the last week for that, we're going to announce some winners for the Wells Tech Photo Challenge. So you'll want to tune into that. There'll be 2 winners for some nice prizes, those who have contributed each week. 3 prizes?
3 winners, yep.
3 winners. How did that happen?
Yeah.
Lost one.
Let me check it out.
What are the 3 winners for?
I'm getting there any moment now.
There's a page someplace that says all this, because right. This was like ages ago where we talked about this.
There's a drawing for the people that submitted something all 12 months. Their names will go in a drawing, and they're going to win an Oleoclip iPhone lens or a Photo Jojo iPhone or Android lens set. That value's $99. And then there's 2 drawings. One is from all the people that have submitted. So even if you submitted just 1 photo, your name is in that drawing with an equal chance of winning among all the people that have submitted. And then there's an award for the photographer with the most original image. So we've got 916 to look through, Martin, to make that decision. So 3 different prizes. Those last 2 will win a Photo Jojo iPhone and Android lens set worth $49. So 3 prizes.
So we got some work to do. That'll be fun. I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to next week, when we're going to do a roundtable interview with some Wells folks who went to ISTE. Now, I should have looked up what ISTE was again, but that's what is ISTE?
I believe it's the International Society of Technology and Education.
There you go. It happens every year. It's a huge conference for technology and education, and we've got 3 folks that have probably contributed in one way or another to the show over the years. So I'm looking forward to having them on and give us their impressions And if so, if you've thought maybe you'd like to go to ISTE, but would like maybe a firsthand retrospective of their impressions of ISTE before you kind of make that commitment for next year, and this next show is for you. So tune in next week for our ISTE Roundtable.
Looking forward to it.
That's going to about do it for our show this week. Thank you for joining us once again, and we hope to see you next week. Blessings. Have a great week. Bye-bye.